Talk given Saturday, 22nd July, 1978. Let us first recall some essential points which we dealt with at our last meeting, because several of you here haven't heard that. We considered the meaning of the word religion, its derivation from either the Latin verb re legere, which Cicero used in his De Rerum Natura on the nature of the gods, and re ligare, which others like Servius, Lactantius, and St. Augustine used. And the meanings of both these verbs are more or less the same. The essential point being that the realization of something which is a totality, which is transcendence, in which everything is included, is that in which we live and move and have our being. And the verbs mean, the two Latin verbs mean relating ourselves back to that transcendent whole. This is what we have not woken up to. The whole history of the human race, its development, the purpose of its existence, its evolution, is that we shall wake up to this. In waking up to it, we do not merely think it. Mere thought doesn't produce that wakefulness. It doesn't release the state of complete relationship, a living integration into the totality. When it does, and as it does, then our whole life is completely different in quality, in its outward expressions towards the human race and in our world, and also in terms of our inner awareness. We are never unaware of the transcendent reality. Now, this is not the case with the human race, and has not been the case for our whole period of evolution. Apart from the exceptional few in whom and through whom this realization came into being and into complete fruitful expression as manhood. The real meaning of the word man is manifest only in the spiritual, liberated, perfected holy ones. We are still, without using the word derogatorily, in a subhuman state. It is only when we have grown out of this subhuman condition and realized full humanity that the purpose of our particular kingdom in nature, the human kingdom, has been fulfilled. Fulfilled through us, not by us. It is not our attainment or achievement. It is not our blessedness or nirvana or kingdom of heaven or the state of the Unio Mystica or any such thing. It is transcendence itself. It is the total universe which comes to fruition through this species we call the human species. And it is, as the scriptures, all the scriptures of the world beautifully put it, it is the glory of God which is manifest through us as humanity, as mankind, and as the individual man. Now, this is a point which we must fully appreciate, because it involves, if we are really concerned with religious living and fulfilling the purpose of our existence, it involves total commitment to the vision of such things. Our vision begins as so many thoughts, so many ideas, mere concepts, strings of words, which produce an intellectual response, an emotional thrill, produce feelings of an exalted or a sublime nature, but which are only the first step in the process of our complete transformation. This is the meaning of growth. Whatsoever is living grows simply means that there is continuous change. But what sort of a change? Is it a regressive change? Is it a fortuitous change? Is it a meaningless, purposeless change? Or has it some wonderful potentiality within it which is coming to fruition? And which is not a limited thing. It is an unlimited thing. Because if we look at the total universe, one of the things that completely astonishes the person who truly sees is the multitudinous variety in terms of perfect beauty and fulfillment and wonder throughout the whole universe of each individual thing. This is the marvel. Now, this involves total commitment by each one of us towards this end. And this end, in actuality, remains unknown. It is unknowable. We can use words like this. We can put it in more beautiful forms in terms of concepts and words. But in its actuality, to us as we are, it is unknown. When, by any chance, I use the word chance, but it's not chance in the ordinary meaning of the word, when we, any one of us, does grow into that state of complete holiness, wholeness, complete purity, if any one of us realizes that state, then we are it. And in that sense, we know it. Not in the sense of the brain being able to know it, but the mind in its totality knows by being, not by acquiring concepts or forming concepts. This is something which is not easy to grasp. It's very difficult. We think we grasp it, because the intellect says, oh yes, of course, this is logically so. This is true. Now, up to a point, the intellect does reflect somewhat distortedly, somewhat waveredly, the actual fact. But as and when the actual fact is realized, intellectual knowing has completely given place to actual being. And when one actually is that, then one just takes it in one stride without knowing it, as we might say. The brain is completely quiet. It is at rest. It is not defeated, but it is at rest. It doesn't interfere with that kind of transcendent knowing, which is knowing in the sense of omniscience. See, something utterly different. Right. So, this total commitment involves also beginning to see the trends of life. The trends of life for us as human beings, because we are human specimens, or subhuman specimens, as the case may be, the trends of life for us. And those trends are embodied in teachings, as we find, for instance, in the Upanishads, the Chandogya Upanishad, when it is said that Brahman is life. But what sort of life? That question should not be asked, because the question is couched in the terms of limitation, whereas the life of the Absolute has no limitation to it. And as I said a few moments ago, the multitudinous variety is there. You see? Therefore, our task becomes a little more confined, a little easier, therefore, to understanding the trend of life for us. That through us, mind will come to full fruition in terms of the universal activity of this energy we call mind, through an utterly purified psyche, through an unresisting, completely pure psychophysical being, man. Then the meaning of the word man, and particularly the meaning of the word human, has really flowered out. And the purpose of our existence as members of a human kingdom has been fulfilled. As the Buddha said, for instance, done what was to, what had to be done. You see? Now, this total commitment involves many things. We have to learn to see quite clearly that there is nothing for ourself. You see, it's one of the, I suppose, unavoidable pathetic aspects of religious teachings, that they talk of a goal which is a pleasant one. It's the kingdom of heaven, or nirvana, or moksha, or a wonderful liberated state, etc., etc. But it has all got to be one-sided. The pleasant. Look at it carefully. It's the carrot held out to the human donkey, myself, which I call myself. It is somewhat pathetic that that should be the case. This thing, this particular individual, whose particularity is what I, the individual, am extremely conscious of. When he dies, dies, we do not face in fullness the meaning of death. We associate it with annihilation, so we are afraid of death. We like to stave it off. We do not realize that Brahman being life and Brahman being the absolute, the totality, which we can perhaps begin to sense in terms of infinity, immeasurability, immortality, implies the complete simultaneity and unity of what we call life, of course, and what we commonly call death. What is it that we become free of? The sting of death. The victory, as it is put, of the grave. The grave has no victory. Death has no sting. It is because we are unawake and incapable of responding to the nature of life in its wholeness, in its uttermost holiness, that we separate life and death. But these are everlastingly together. There. Just like that. If only one experiences a true realization, a true enlightenment at any particular moment, and you suddenly wake up, oh yes, of course, that's it. Next moment, it may disappear and may not come again for a long time. Or it may remain with one. If we only had that sort of awakening, then there's a wonderful freedom which permeates our whole consciousness, not just a part of our consciousness, but our entire consciousness is permeated with this freedom, which is the true spiritual freedom, which is the crowning glory of the human spirit. Let that come, and so much of the striving and anxiety and bitterness, the confusion and all the rest of it from which we suffer will naturally fall away from us. It won't enter us at all. Thoughts will come, feelings will arise. Pleasure and pain will of course play their part in dualistic, finite living. Joy and sorrow also simultaneously. They will all be present, but this inner freedom, this mysterious transcendent power will work through one's being and enable us to live naturally and spontaneously in tune with the trends of life for humanity, without the brain knowing it or bothering about it. Now that is one thing. So we must realize there is nothing for me. The me is an intrusion upon the universal scheme. This consciousness of I am I. It's an intrusion upon the universal scheme. That consciousness of I am I, implying that I am not you or the other person or the other thing, vanishes. This is the awakening within ourselves, the turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness. This is the true metanoia, the conversion, if you like, in the grand sense. And then one is truly enthusiastic. Not emotionally, not a nervous upset, but in its original meaning. Enthusiastic means filled with God, theos. That's where the theos part comes in. Filled with God. And God is the absolute all. The unknown and the unknowable absolute all. But we are an intrusion upon that because of our unawakened state. And our intrusion is specifically exemplified in our sense of me, the sense of I-ness and I-hood, and the clinging to egohood, the clinging to the separateness. It is the separative, isolative self-consciousness which is the driving force right in our innermost depths, which brings about all our human evil and unnecessary suffering. There is that element which is necessary suffering, which is unavoidable, which should not be avoided. We must not retreat from life, from the reality of life. Note how the perfected holy ones are the very ones who undergo the profoundest sorrow. Why? Because the 4,000 millions of the world are in grief unnecessarily, are unawakened, are in confusion, and the instruments of evil. You see, it's like that. So, there is nothing for me. I don't attain nirvana. I don't grasp, I cannot grasp the infinite, the absolute. It's perfectly ridiculous. It's as absurd as thinking that you can take your teacup and pour the whole of, empty the whole of the Atlantic into it. Can't do it. I'll tell you a funny little story here. Which is a true story. My sister is 11 years my junior, and when we were little and I used to take her out to the sea beach in Colombo and play with her, and she would ask me questions. What is on the other side of this sea, the Indian Ocean? I said, well, if you go in that direction, you'll come to Australia. So she said, she was only four years old then, and she said, oh, I want to get to Australia. I said, you can't, you've got this tremendous sea before you. In a split second she answered, I'll drink it all up. Out of the mouth of babes. But what an extraordinary thing, the utter spontaneity out of the state of complete innocence, non-harmingness, innocence, innocence, not hurting. The child says a thing like that. Obviously, there is no sense of grasping or achieving. The emphasis is not, I shall get to Australia, but I shall get to Australia by drinking the whole sea up. You see, the nuance involved there. These are wonderful lessons from which one may learn quite a lot. So now, we must have to realize that there is nothing for oneself. If one realizes that, what happens to greed? It disappears. What am I going to grasp? We are all told, we all know, we all repeat it like parrots, but like parrots unfaithful to truth. We say, you can't take it with you. in relationship to our own death, when we try to contemplate our own death, you can't take it with you. But we jolly well don't believe it. And if we believe it in literal terms, then we compensate our greedy psyches by saying, but I shall get to heaven and get its rewards. I should like to meet the person who is quite aware that he will get to hell because he is a bad lot, and that's the right place for him afterwards. If you meet some such person, do introduce him to me. I should be delighted. You see how our psyches work. So now, if one does realize that there is nothing for me, greed ceases, there is no more a grasping. We grasp after serving God, serving mankind, and all the rest of it. We are greedy for the good results, as we say, of that act, of that kind of activity. Be very careful. I, for one, certainly do not know what is for the good of mankind. It's a presumption. It is just conceit on my part to say, this is good for so and so, I will tell him this, or I'll do that for him, or put him in the way of so and so. No. If, with a completely open mind and a clean heart, that is free of all desire and grasping, he and I meet, and he desires to understand something from me, or to ask me to help him with something where I can help him, all right, let him ask, and I shall do the best I can for him, and that is all. And then be completely unconcerned whether it did him any good or brought a good result or anything. Who am I to measure? If each individual is indeed transcendence embodied in actuality, working to come out into complete fruition, if each one of us is that indeed, then who are we to ask what is the good? We don't know the good. Let us be content to be continuously waking up to the good. By hindsight, perhaps, we can see, that was good. It was in harmony with the trend of life. Another thing, if we see the trend of life and let all our life energy flow into our life process in thought and feeling, in speech and action, in such a manner that it is vibrating in some sort of tune with the trend of life. If we let that happen, then can we seek teachers? Somebody to teach us the way, to show us the way. Granted, here there is a perfected Holy One. Granted the fact, I am seeking a teacher. Now, have I the qualifications? Have I the perception? Have I the sensitivities which will recognize him? Why do we need a particular teacher? We say quite glibly, we live and move and have our being in him, in transcendence itself. We talk about the omnipresence of the Supreme, the Perfect, the Absolute. and we deny what we say with our lips by our activities every day of our lives. We just deny the fact, don't we? So, just as it takes your skilled, your trained jeweler to evaluate a gem, so it takes the skilled, perceiving, awakened person to recognize another holy one. I can't choose. There is no point in seeking a teacher specifically. Because when I seek like that, I am seeking for myself. And it is this myself which is the obtrusion upon the truth, the holiness of the totality. But if I remain open-minded, open-hearted, watchful, alert, but without seeking anything positively, that's the important part, then my sensitivities become sharpened. And when someone from whom I can learn is present, I do learn from him. When something happens, I do learn from the event. It is in this way that the learner confers teacherhood upon the teacher. The teacher may be a steam engine, if you like. It may be a bird singing in a tree. Or it may be a lioness killing her prey for food. But if I'm in the state of sensitivity, of watchfulness, then I learn from it. And this learning specifically is a releasing and opening out of inner consciousness in such a manner that there is no problem of acceptance or non-acceptance, of rejection or non-rejection with respect to anything and everything in the universe. I'm making it as usual, or rather trying to make it as difficult as possible for everybody. But do remember that the creations of a Shakespeare or a Beethoven or a Michelangelo do not come out without tears, toil, sweat and blood, and a complete inward transformation. A baptism not only by water, but by fire. And it is this sort of baptism which does not burn away the dross, but it converts the dross also into the pure metal. Because there is nothing in the universe that can be annihilated. It can be transformed. And if this spirit, this type of consciousness just really does emerge, howsoever slowly, then we are beginning to be men and women in the true sense of the word. Standing on our own feet, not rejecting anybody or anything, but always learning from everybody and everything. And in that learning, there is a continuous and perpetual interrelationship which is a true union, a true unity. Without our restricting that unity by giving it particular shapes deliberately. Because whatsoever the intellect does deliberately in that way, will invariably fall short of the marvel and beauty and wonder of the actuality, which is the whole, the holiness. We stand on holy ground everywhere. We move through that which is perpetually holy, all the time. But our touch besmirches that holiness. But that holiness is continuously self-healing. Therefore, though we besmirch it with our touch, our subhuman touch, it is again itself. You cannot slay or hurt the immortal, the infinite. You cannot measure and confine the immeasurable. You can only wake up to all these things within your own self and grow into the likeness of the pure human being. These things we must realize. And these things are involved in this total commitment. Now there's another aspect which we must stress, emphasize. Once something of a clear vision begins to grow within ourselves, compassionateness begins to emerge. You see, we use this word love, one of the least understood words and least effective and functioning words, not merely in our languages but in our whole lives. We use this word love. What do we mean by it in actuality? Grasping, holding, possessing, dominating, an emotion, a sensation, a madness. Look how we behave when our love is thwarted, when we are jilted, when we are deceived by the other person, or when the other person hurts us in innumerable ways. And the ways are innumerable in which we can be hurt. We have so many sensitive points, sensitive in the wrong way. That is to say, when this or that or any one of those innumerable things happens to us, we react back against it. If we really loved and cared, we'd just take it into our psyche. I've said 1,000 times, but don't believe it, please. Find it out for yourself. The psyche cannot be killed. You, the psychophysical organism, will suffer bodily pain. You will suffer psychical pain because of reactions from within yourself, which are due to your self-concept. If the self-concept is not there, such reactions don't take place. And then there is no pain. You just take it in. Watch a really intelligent parent who is blessed by God, if you like, by nature, if you like, with just the right kind of sensitivity. Now, whatever the infant does, receives no antagonistic reaction from the parent. The parent takes it all in, helps the child to get along the right lines. I've seen little children, you know, in their exuberance, slap their parents hard or poke them in sensitive places and so forth, and the parent never reacted in anger or displeasure or that kind of admonition which would introduce the element of fear in the infant. Now this is real parenthood. This is love like God loves. I'm presuming to say what God's love is like. Forgive the presumption, but I hope you will understand what I am trying to convey. It is a divine love. You completely take it into yourself. And in that, your wholeness, your true individuality, indivisibility from everything in the universe in terms of your own mind and consciousness is manifest. Then you are the true individual. Then when you say I, you do not say I as separate from you or the other thing. There is no otherness at all. There is only the totality. There is only transcendence. So you see, what is this thing love? That in which there is no otherness. That in which there is no reaction of any sort, of a finite, analyzable, conceivable, talkable nature. I don't know with the brain, and never can know with the brain, what love is. But through this total commitment to the trends of life and living in harmony with that trend as best as we can, this thing we call compassion grows naturally. The original real meaning of compassion is to vibrate in tune with. That is compassion. To vibrate in tune with. And if you vibrate in tune with, then you are in harmony with it. And that harmony is the unity. Not constricted or subjected to uniformity, but the marvel of the unity, that it can express itself in perpetually changing forms which are everlastingly of the nature of the beauty and the order of the universe itself. And all this kind of thing, as far as I can see, is involved in this total commitment to living the religious life.